Hi, Bloodstream listeners. Host Patrick here, and you are listening to an important special episode of the Bloodstream podcast, a crossover episode with my podcasting colleague, Dr. Amar Zaidi from Cheatcodes, a sickle cell podcast. And this conversation we're about to have features two guests, Andre Marcel Harris and Philip Okwo, both people living with sickle cell, both deep thinking and intellectual advocates, and both black men. Amar and I invited them to participate in a Facebook Live with us on Friday, June 5th, titled simply, Racism in America. Amar has often said that sickle cell is a biopsychosocial disease. And while I am neither a patient nor an expert on sickle cell disease, having spent most of my life in the company of people with sickle cell, a disease that overwhelmingly affects black people, in my opinion, it's impossible to have a meaningful discussion about care and treatment for people with sickle cell if you're not willing to discuss race, prejudice, discrimination, and systemic obstacles. And given the recent events, which we will discuss and you'll hear Phil and Andre speak to shortly, it felt like having a conversation on race in America would not only be appropriate for Amar and I to do as part of Bloodstream Media, but was necessary to do as part of Bloodstream Media. I'm grateful to have had Phil and Andre come on. I'm very thankful to have met these two impressive humans and advocates, circumstances notwithstanding. And I'm grateful to Amar, Dr. Z, for recommending and inviting them to join us. Please forgive audio glitches, as this was a live stream we put together with people from four states on short notice during a weekday, and actually while one of us was in a car waiting for a doctor's appointment, so we really did our best to make things work. And if you pick up on a problem or two, sorry about that. To be real with you for just a quick minute before we get into the audio from Friday, I was more nervous and anxious about this discussion than any live or maybe any conversation that I've had as a part of Bloodstream Media to date. I felt and still feel so inadequate. And that's the best word that I've got for it right now. Inadequate. And I'm grateful that there was an organic moment in the discussion for me to speak to that inadequacy and my insecurity about how to behave and what to do in this moment as a well-meaning, generally mindful white person. And I'm glad that I didn't let inadequacy have me swallow that question, because it's an important question, and it's one that those gentlemen had some important things to say about. Stick around after the conversation with Phil, Andre, and Amar, and we will talk a little bit more. But now, we'll jump into the audio from the live on Friday, June 5th, Racism in America, with Dr. Amar Zaidi, Philip Okwo, and Andre Marcel Harris.
Amar, I know that we will be talking about sickle cell in part. I wish that we were speaking predominantly about sickle cell today, but unfortunately we're here for a very necessary, much larger conversation.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for giving us some time on this platform to discuss this immensely important issue. I really think that conversations surrounding what's going on in this country right now is a step in the right direction. Honest, open communication with individuals who are well-versed and very aware of the history of the Black community in this country, sort of compounded by their own battle with a chronic disease. I think that that perspective for us is going to be really important. So when we started sort of conceptualizing this Facebook Live, immediately I thought of two individuals who I have had the sort of fortune of crossing paths with in my life, because I draw inspiration from them. I remember our conversations, even though they were brief and, not as frequent as I would like. I draw back to those conversations I had with these two individuals, being Philip and Andre, and I thought of them immediately, because this is the time to listen to the Black community. This is the time to give the Black community our attention and give them a platform where they can help us help them. So Patrick, if it's okay with you, I want to jump into this conversation so that—
Please, yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, awesome. Well, Andre and Philip, I thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this with us, man. We really appreciate you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Of course, man. I want to jump right into it. Of course, you know, racism in America, unfortunately, particularly regarding the Black community, this is like a 400-year-old problem. And it's not something that we can cover in 1 hour of a Facebook Live. But I wanna sort of start by talking about the history of racism in this country and sort of have you guys tell that story to us. So I'm gonna kick it to you, Phil, and just you know get us started on a little bit. Lay the context of how we ended up with today. What got us here?
Sure. Well, last year, 2019, was celebrated in Ghana and other parts of West Africa as the year of the return. It marked 400 years from when the first slaves were, taken on the transatlantic slave trade. And so most people are very familiar with the slavery aspect of that story, whether you're American or not. But I think what some of our fellow Americans who may not necessarily be familiar with the African-American experience may not understand is some of the ways in which, you know, some more overt, others covert, in which kind of the model of slavery has morphed and transitioned into much more systemic and I guess arguably less overtly racist methods of subjugation for the Black community. And you know, we saw this transition from slavery into Jim Crow, and then arguably what we see now in terms of mass incarceration is has been referred to as a new Jim Crow. And the police brutality that people are protesting right now is an arm of that, but it is by no means the entire picture. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg. And so you know, racism in America, it's so vast and it's so deep. And again, it has a lot to do with the criminal justice system, but it also has a lot to do with the economic opportunities or lack thereof for the African American community and some of the methods in which it has been enshrined in law to withhold some of those opportunities for African American communities. And that just makes them even more vulnerable to the criminal justice system at large. So I'll leave some time for Andre to jump in, and you know, it is a big topic, so I won't try to filibuster at this point, but I think that's probably the best I can do on a high level right now.
Andre, what do you got? Thanks, Phil, for that. That was a really nice summary. Andre.
So first of all, I think Phil should have a podcast named The Filibuster.
Oh,
and
wow.
It should be spelled P-H-I-L, filibuster.
I love that.
That just came to me. You should run with that because that was cool. but I wanted to, echo with my brother and really say that ever since the George Floyd murder, a lot of people have been asking the question, why now, or why was it him that sparked what some people would say chaos? But for others, Phil and I would say for others like us, we understand that he was just the feather on the camel's back. But it's not to devalue the fact that we have been protesting, we have been speaking out, we have been trying to make our voices heard. And inherently, whenever we try to make our voices heard, it seems as if whatever we do to communicate, you know, the pain that we're going through, it's devalued from a structural level. So that being said, even as Phil said, if you understand the history, one thing that kind of warmed my heart is that the other day, Amazon said that the top 20 books that were sold were anti-racism literature. And I think that's great because that means people are hungry for knowledge. People are hungry to understand what can they do to dismantle this system of racism. And to further expand the point, so one thing that people really don't understand, because it's not taught in our curriculum in public schools, and I doubt it's taught in any private or charter school system, But even in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, when we think about redlining and gerrymandering even, and we talk about redistricting, and we talk about all of the ways that African-Americans were kept out of white communities,
right,
for the fear that they would devalue the community. And I'm reading a book called The Color of Law, mm-hmm, that really destroys a lot of the ideologies that white nationalists and white supremacists, ground themselves in, is that the data does not prove that African-Americans' presence, of course we know, you know, our presence wouldn't, but even the data shows that our presence not only improved the property values, but it like tripled property values because of certain discriminatory practices that we were subject to. We were subject to blockbusting. We were subject to all of these things that the government supported. And so that is the thing that really speaks volumes to me, is that in order to dismantle this system, we have to be educated about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why the needle has not moved so far, is because a lot of people have held on to their whitewashed history that's taught in our, you know, regular curriculums throughout this country. Mm-hmm. And we're really not given the knowledge that really tells us why. And to kind of succinctly wrap this portion up of my comment, someone would ask, why is it so significant about the housing discriminatory practices? If we know that property tax funds schools, and we know that education is one of the social determinants of not only your health, but your upward mobility, all of these things that will establish you as a quote unquote good citizen or someone that can pursue the American dream. If you are in a redline community, even in 2020, there are still communities that were redlined that are still overwhelmingly segregated from the white communities. And so if these tenants are not paying mortgage, but they're paying rent because they were denied a mortgage just because they were Black, then the property taxes won't be as high. The property taxes won't be paid because they're paying rent. And then that means the school systems that they support with these rents instead of mortgages are going to be dilapidated. The education is going to be subpar. And then if you don't have a good primary and secondary education, then your higher education statistically suffers. And then if you don't get a good degree, then you won't have a good chance at a good job. And even today, I was listening to Reuters, and they said even a Black family who has an advanced degree still has, I think, three times less the wealth of a white family that has a high school diploma. Why is that? Because property, owning land, owning property has been able to be a vehicle for white families to pass down generational wealth. But because we were denied that right or denied that access, then we have no way to pass down generational wealth. And so again, 400 years later, even though we're not physically bound in chains, slavery is just rewritten into another narrative. And we're, you know, mentally slaves to a system, and we're socially held slaves to a system that we now say was never, you know, made for us. It's not broken. It's operating like it was made to operate. Mm-hmm. So in order to fix it, we have to totally rewrite and reconstruct the system.
And that's such a valid point. This racial wealth gap is so large at this point because of the reasons that you just explained, that, you know, this narrative of if people just worked harder, if they just educated themselves more, they wouldn't be this issue. That's not true, right? We have plenty of people that are working hard, that are getting educated, they're going to college, but for all the reasons you said, they can't overcome that racial wealth gap, right? And it's going to take a lot more than hard work and hustle to overcome a racial wealth gap that has grown over 400 years for those exact reasons.
I hope I could just interject this real quick. I think that kind of speaks to your point. one of my favorite speeches and favorite quotes that Martin Luther King said, and I hate to use him as the token quote person, but he talked about, you know, it's a cruel jest to say that a man should pull himself up by the bootstraps. At first, you know, paraphrasing, if first of all, they have no boots. So people are expecting African-Americans and even other people of color to pull themselves up by the bootstraps when they are shoeless. It's impossible. Fair. It's a cruel jest to expect us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps.
Yeah, no, that's so true, man. That's so true. Phil, when you look at this in the context of history, that context that you laid down for us, this point that we're at in America in 2020, where do you see this in 20 years, in 50 years, in 100 years, when people look back at 2020? What could this point in time be for Black history in America when we're writing history books in 2050?
That's a great question. And I think a lot of it is going to have to do with how we come together as a community and respond to this moment. I think that how we got here is certainly the culmination of a series of incidents, as was laid out at the top of this this live. And I certainly believe that some of the responses on all sides potentially have been accelerated by the anxiety of the pandemic that we're living through. Mm-hmm. And I heard it recently said that perhaps we might need a return to the village of Africa, by which it was meant that we should try to find healing in the sense of our community. And so, you know, the Black community has certainly through a kind of a spiritual expression, we've had that, but I think even on a broader kind of mental health and a nurturing of our voice through forums like this, come together to find modes of expression where even if the broader American public doesn't necessarily understand our point of view or welcome our point of view, we can somehow find a way to heal and to rise amongst our own, you know, amongst, you know, the collective of the African American community. I think some of the approaches, there are certainly some new skill sets that'll be required from that. New approaches, new perspectives. But I'd like to think that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we as a community decided that there are certain things that we must do for ourselves, regardless of whether or not it seems the broader American population is responsive. Mm. There has been a lot of reason for encouragement. Again, forums like this, a lot of the public remarks made by a number of different heads of companies and other, you know, even here in Atlanta, the Children's Museum sent out something today talking about how they're with the community. So that has been encouraging. But at the end of the day, I think there has been historically, as a function of this racism, this kind of repeated subtextual value judgment on the value of our voice and of our expression. Mm-hmm. And in as much as the total systemic racism in the United States has been kind of a game of inches, it's not just the police brutality, although that's the most visible expression, but it's, for sure, again, all these little maneuvers here and there, both within the law and outside of the law. But it's been even, for example, the forms of protest, very peaceful protests through the likes of Colin Kaepernick, mm-hmm, that were rejected, that, again, there's an implicit value judgment that your voice as a Black man, whether you are wealthy or not, famous or not, it doesn't have value. And so we find ourselves at this point because as long as that value judgment keeps getting made on implicit and explicit levels, that our voice isn't valued, whether it's peaceful or not, then we come to the point where we have to ask ourselves, well, then if it wasn't valued when it was peaceful, then why not express it in perhaps more demonstrative ways like these riots, mm-hmm. right? And it doesn't by any means condone. We don't condone, you know, the destruction of property, but we're people in a community that seems to have been left with very few options. So
for sure. So for me, I mean, as you know, I have through my work with sickle cell disease, I have really entrenched myself with friends who are Black, both patients, providers, advocates, things like this. I as a minority myself, a minority that has came to this country in a situation where Black people had fought for minority rights already. We came to a country that was more accepting of minorities because of the bloodshed and the oppression of Black people that you fought against, right? So to me, even though, you know, I'm not part of the Black community, I feel a tremendous debt to the Black community in raising that type of minority awareness. I think that I have a lot of feelings about this and how I can contribute and what me as a minority can do. I think though, before I get to that, because that's a huge topic, before I jump into that, you know, one thing that I think about frequently is in 2020, social media is, you guys know, a powerful tool. We saw 45 use social media to flip the country over, right? And make it his. And there's no way to understate the power of social media. You know, in 1991, we saw LAPD beat down an American construction worker named Rodney Glenn King, right? And America was mad then, right? And then, just like Patrick said, there's no shortage of names that we can pull, from Trayvon Martin to Breonna to, you know, of course, now George. I feel like the anger that we had as a country for Rodney King in 1991, how did we lose our interest? How did America as a country just not care? You know, like, what, this happens, how many reminders do we need, right, before it's enough? What do you guys think is the best way to keep this in the public eye continuously?
If I could jump in on that, I first would like to preface what I'm going to reply to you by saying, like you said before, I think, you know, when Rodney King was beat, I was only 2 years old. So, of course, I don't remember that moment. I did learn about it in history, but I wasn't in the moment. But again, like you said, social media wields a powerful weapon. And, you know, back then we didn't have social media. I think the fact that cell phone footage is catching and documenting a lot of the stuff that pre-cell phone footage did not see, I think that's what's adding fuel to the flames, to me, in a good way, because especially with George Floyd, especially with some of Philando Castile and some of the others, Sean Reed, that were killed while social media was watching on a live stream platform or on a video platform. I am overconfident to say that if those videos did not exist, the recognition would never get to the level that it is. And even with Philando Castile and others, even though it was the revolution, so to speak, was televised, the justice still was not actualized. And that's the sad part to me, is that even if we had video proof, that still doesn't seem to be enough. So to answer your question, I think continuing to be vocal on social media and, like you said, wielding its power, I think is key. A lot of people demonize social media, but it can help. In any times we have mediums like that, there's always going to be a pro and there's always going to be a con. Yeah. And you have to learn how to take advantage of that platform to your, you know, for your good. Yeah. And then I also wanted to say, kind of to speaking towards what we see about the vehement protests, like Phil said, I think COVID-19 is also another match that was lit that kind of spread the flames, because we were already on in about the racial injustice that we saw just with COVID-19, just with the health disparities we saw. So when more people, Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, had died months before most people even knew about it. And I think that honestly added a lot of tension as well, because we felt like this should have been something the media covered to keep us informed. And to kind of wrap up what I'm saying is, I think one thing is to hold the media accountable as well, because what really grinds my gears is when we protest, most of the time they are peaceful. Most of the time they are very platonic. But when here in North Carolina, some of the schools here, whenever they lose a football game or a hockey game or any type of game, they will tear the city down. But the media will report that, you know, just rowdy college kids were having a good time. But if we fight against being murdered, then we are labeled thugs and lawless. And to me, that's why I made, you know, and I've gotten controversy. Again, I don't just, you know, condone, like Phil said, people going out and being violent intentionally. And I don't condone people destroying innocent bystanders, you know, property and all of that. But at the same time, I do think that there is a place for demonstratively speaking out, especially when it comes to vestiges of slavery and vestiges of Jim Crow and vestiges of the Confederacy. So when I see people defacing Confederate statues, it doesn't bother me. When I see people tumbling over buildings with, you know, that honor Confederate soldiers that were openly white supremacists, it doesn't bother me. So those are the things I want to say, because when our communities were terrorized and people were coming into our homes and snatching people out of their beds and hanging them on a tree, no one cared. But now people care that we are protesting, that you understand that Black lives matter. No, we're not devaluing all lives. No, we're not devaluing, you know, Hispanic or Middle Eastern lives. But at this point, we are trying to bring to the forefront that Black lives matter, because seemingly no one else other than Black people care. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, that is, that's so true. I, this all lives matter thing is bothering me too, because, I don't know, man. Someone recently told me, like, if someone's grandma died, you wouldn't roll up to the funeral and be like, but all grandmas matter. Like, you would spend that day being like, you know, why I care about you, and I'm sad for this, and how can I support you? That's true. Phil, anything you want to add to what Andre just said?
Yeah, I would absolutely love to expound. I think the question you asked is, did we fall asleep? You know, what happened between Rodney King and here is such a great one. And Andre is right that social media and the proliferation of cameras everywhere is going to help, because a lot of the stories that we've been telling since, you know, NWA, since Marvin Gaye's, like, what's going on? Like, these are the stories that have been told, but they didn't, you can only tell so much of a story through a song, right? And so capturing that imagery does help to tell the story, but I fear for what Killer Mike alluded to over the weekend, what might become a sense of murder porn, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're seeing these things captured on social media, and they get proliferated, they go viral. Mm-hmm. I think that what we hopefully would need to see more of is much more attention to, again, the kind of some of the inner working, much more investigative reporting on the less sensationalizable aspects of systemic racism in America, right? And so the confrontation of a Black man with a police officer, or any Black individual with a police officer, is going to generate.
I think the only time
we talk about this, it shouldn't be the only time it gets reported on the news. And that is the most readily sensationalizable aspect of it. But that's not all of it. It goes so much deeper than that. Again, that is just the tip of the iceberg. So when we talk about, the value judgments around what is the importance of the black voice, that's not just manifesting in like the protests of NFL players. What about when we as patients find ourselves in the emergency room and we let a doctor know that, hey, this type of narcotic doesn't work for my sickle cell? Mm-hmm. There's a value judgment that your voice doesn't matter. And so again, the doctors, we respect that they retain, but we as people who live with chronic condition from birth, we have some say and some skin in the game as far as like what treatment methodologies are going to work best for us. And so when we show up to the ER and we have certain dialogue and get dismissed as either drug seeking or whatever, that value judgment recurs that your life, your voice as a Black person, as a Black patient, has no value, and it won't be incorporated in your care, even though you'll be paying the bill, right? And so these are the things that, again, they poke their ugly head over and over. What's the value judgment on the fact, there's the idea that slaves back in the day were only given like the throwaway parts of the pig, chitlins and stuff like that. Well, that value judgment, slavery doesn't exist. But when you go and look in predominantly Black and brown communities today and you see that they're food deserts and there's no investments in groceries and there's no investments in nutritious food, that value judgment is, again, it's a recurring thing. So why doesn't that get as much attention from the news as the standoffs against police, right? And so that's the thing where, again, we don't fall asleep per se as we get lulled to thinking that if there was no confrontation this week, I guess, racism is in check this week. And so what are the invisible ways, the faceless ways in which it continues to go on in between the instances of police brutality? I don't have necessarily the answer at the ready, but I think those are the things that potentially get overlooked and that make us, again, they draw us into this lull where it does feel like we're asleep. It does feel like we don't, that things, racism isn't still moving when it is very much, it's at scale. When you live in a capitalist society like the America, like the United States, people go to sleep, people get sick, but it's systems that run 24/7. And so that's the thing we need to do a better job peeling the layers back on. With both the media, as Andre alluded to, and in discussions like this.
Those are amazing insights from the both of you, man. I just want to...
Dr. Z?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want a quick addendum.
Absolutely. No, you don't have to apologize.
And because Phil is the man. I really want to say with what he said, not to devalue what he said, but just add some context. Is I heard the other day listening to a podcast, and I never thought about it this way. It's not Black people's job to dismantle racism. Mm. It's the people who created it. Yes. If you created it, then you have to put as much time to dismantle it. Yes, you may not have been the person who was, there in 1776, but still, your privilege contributes to the monster or to the machine of racism. Mm-hmm. So therefore your voice will really matter more in its destruction than ours. Because again, we are marginalized. People are not going to care as much about this. We could Black Lives Matter until we're blue in the face, but some of the things that I have seen have been positive changes, unfortunately, came from our white counterparts who were in government, or our white counterparts who had wealth and access to power, to actually use their platform to cause destruction in this system. And I think to go back to your question, I think because we live it, we just like Phil talked about, sickle cell is something we were, you know, we were born with it. We were born Black. We didn't wake up yesterday being Black, just, you know, miraculously. So I think sometimes it's not that we fell asleep, but we become numb to it. It's, we're used to it. It's like an extra finger or extra arm or whatever. It's a part of us, whether we want to admit it or not. And then like I told someone else, I feel like, this is just my assumption, I feel like every person of color, especially every African-American, has been a victim of overt or covert racism. They just may not know it. Because I asked the question, you know, have you been a victim of racism? And someone said no. I'm like, you never know behind the scenes on what, you know, from a structural and institutional level, the things that you were victim of racism. So I say that to say we experience it every day and we become numb. So really the people who really have to take a stake this time to really help us, and I'm not saying that we don't have a, you know, skin in the game either, but the people who constructed this system have to be one of the main players in destructing it as well.
Yeah, I
mean, I'd love to ask a quick follow-up along those lines, actually, because this is something that I think about a bit. Because when I think about myself as a white man, the word privilege is only something in the last few years that I actually have come to peace with. Because I didn't, for a long time, I'd hear that word and think, I don't feel like I'm a privileged person. Like, I grew up with hemophilia. My dad wasn't around. I had to move school. I had all these hard things in my life.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got to a certain point, and I think the time it resonated with me was that someone said, like, yes, that's all true. And imagine if you were Black. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, at the right age, helped me understand what the word meant in this context. And as we have a conversation about, it's not the responsibility of the Black person to deconstruct racism in America, I think, okay, well then it really sounds like it may be the responsibility of white people to do more. So let's look at that category of people. There's people like me, you know, I got my Black Lives Matter shirt on, we're having this conversation, I'll make a donation, might go to a protest. Is that enough? And then on the other hand, there's the people who might be way more responsible, the active white supremacists walking around now. But what do we expect them to do today? I don't expect them to do very much. So if they're not doing much, and I think I'm doing enough, who's supposed to be doing what? So I would love to hear from each of you.
That's
your response
to
that and how you think about that element of things.
Phil, do you want to jump in and I'll follow you up?
I think one of the things that I guess I'll take the two parts. Someone like yourself, who again is open and receptive to the idea or the concept of privilege and actually doing something to improve the system, versus the person who again might be an active white supremacist and trying more overtly to subvert Black people, Black and brown, whatever you name it. I think for would-be allies like yourself, one of the best things that you can do is continue to inform forums like this, again, that where the value judgment, the value statement, the subtext here is that your voice matters. We want to hear from you. It's such a small thing, but it is a big thing, because we're constantly competing against, we're constantly running up against a society and a system at large that tells us that our voice doesn't matter, right? So this is a good place to start. So kudos to that already. I think one of the things that you could continue to do as an ally is to have those difficult conversations when we aren't necessarily in the room, right? With the folks that they are maybe the more active white supremacists or the more ignorant, but my general opinion on that type of ignorance is that it's a function of the stories that people have heard about us as a community. And so if you grow up with those kinds of views, odds are these were views that you heard in your family or in your immediate community, and less likely that you actually interacted with somebody to come to, you know, of that culture to come to those views. This is like, it's like the Chinese water torture. It's marketing. It's basically the concept of marketing. And so if the stories that get told about the Black community are what you see on Cops and what you see, you know, on The Wire, mm-hmm. then you're going to come up to get with certain views. And so it's hard for me, as much as distasteful as those views are, for me as a person on the receiving end of that, like, I get it. I don't want to make a pass for it. I get it. But it's a reflection of ignorance. And it's a reflection of how the society at large tells stories about us as a people from a specific angle. And so what allies like you can do is have those conversations, dispel that ignorance when we're not in the room, but again, continue to make avenues and make forums where we can tell our stories and represent ourselves in the way that we actually truly are. And so that would be my challenge to the person who is the active racist, is if they can't get it from having conversations like you, is I would challenge them to actually sit down, take a Black person to lunch, take a Black and brown, and try to understand where they're coming from, because we might find, and given the brief history you outlined, that there may be much more in common than you realize. And that's the first step, is just a bit of empathy. And you know, how does empathy scale? Again, it's partially through the right storytelling. It's partially through amplifying the voice of those who are otherwise marginalized. But those would be the two places I'd say we could start. And I'm sure Andre would have a lot of great additions to that.
Yeah, so Phil, you were spot on with what I was going to say to answer your question. I think, first of all, the very explicit, you know, white supremacist, white nationalist, that really supports the idea of segregation and slavery, and you know, they were, you know, they have roots in the Confederate South and all of these things. Those type of people who are still today on police forces or in positions of power to do us harm, not probably, you know, like come out and lynch us, but they may do us harm, like Phil said, behind a closed door in a boardroom. I think those people aren't really, sadly, I just think those people, it would be harder or even impossible to really change their mind about the situation. That could be debatable. However, one thing for people like you, like Phil said, in those behind those closed doors and in those boardrooms, I think this would be a great story to kind of to prove my point. I tried to challenge myself in reading, and I joined Oprah's book club to do that. And so a couple of months ago, she chose a book called American Dirt. And it's a, if you didn't hear about it, it's a book that was written by a non-Latina about a Mexican family, basically, immigrating into the United States from Mexico to escape cartel violence and, you know, all of this stuff. There was a huge uproar about the book itself. Oprah had the writer, and she had the publishing company on her particular show to talk about the book. And here's one thing that I thought was extremely powerful. Even though they were Mexicans, I think it really speaks to all people of color. They willingly admitted that they had no one who was Latina or Latino, Hispanic, or anyone in that similar group on their board, in advisory committees, on their staff, that had the influence to tell them this may not have been a good decision, or this may not have been a good decision. And I think one of the most powerful things that people, as I said, with privilege, inherent privilege, I appreciate you telling and being honest that you didn't really understand that framework until someone kind of broke it down to you. It's an inherent thing. You're born, you know, just like we're born with our Black skin, mm-hmm. You're born with a privilege. Whether you're the poorest of white people, there's still an inherent privilege that we will never get. And so for someone who has that privilege, and you are in those boardrooms, and you are an employee of that company, like Phil said, it is your responsibility, and that's just how I feel, to use your privilege and use your voice and use your advantage to speak up. So for that book, for example, there was part of the cover that was controversial about barbed wire and how, you know, a lot of Mexicans, that is very visceral for them, barbed wires. And so they were saying you could simply fix that because the average Mexican person or the average Latina or Latino would have told you that this is offensive or this could be viewed as offensive. So I hope that makes sense. Of course, you know, what you're doing, it is helpful. But, and of course, everybody like you aren't in those positions where they're, you know, in the boardrooms or they're, you know, on the board. But wherever you may see it, just like when you're flying, when they say, if you see something, say something. I think it's, you know, just the right thing to do. If you see it, you say something and you try to correct that behavior. Yeah. If you have the power to do so. And I think that is very, it may sound simple, but I think that could help a long way. Because I've seen, and I'll wrap it up with this. I saw something on Facebook the other day. Presumably a teenage white girl started recording a conversation with her and her parents. And her parents were basically saying how black people will never amount to anything. Basically, you know, paraphrasing how black people are just ghetto. They live in ghettos and they were born, you know, they were basically destined to be ghetto. And the statistics prove that, you know, that basically like their lives doesn't matter. And you could see this white girl who apparently by her education or her, you know, association or whatever medium it was, her education about the plight of the black people was almost at tears because she was trying to educate her family about why their viewpoints were wrong. Was she successful? Probably not. But she used her privilege to speak up. And that to me speaks volumes. If you are just like they talk about sexual harassment, if you allow people to continue to say inappropriate jokes in your presence, then your silence equals that you condone it from a human resources perspective. So for me, it means a lot more that you are helping to destruct racism. If you think of it as a house, you may be taking down the chandelier every time you speak up. If you think of it that way, you may be taking down a banister every time you speak up, but you may not be hitting the institution with a wrecking ball, but you are destructing it bit by bit, piece by piece, brick by brick, by every time you speak up for us when we're not there or we don't have the respect or the power or the privilege to speak up. Because we do speak up, but it depends on if people would rather listen or not.
You guys gave us so much insight in both of those answers, and there's so much to unpack in both of those answers, and there's some points I want to hit too. You know, speaking of privilege, I'm a minority. I feel like I grew up in Canada. I felt like a Canadian boy, just like everybody else in my class, white adjacent, until, and I think I talked to you guys about this when we met in Fort Lauderdale, until 9/11. And I was 16 years old when 9/11 happened. And that was the first time that I went to school and I was like, people look at me different now. You know, I'm now a Muslim. I'm a brown Muslim. I'm a terrorist now, right? But I think it's privilege in itself that it took for me to be a 16-year-old boy in high school to feel different for the first time in a community that I lived in, right? That's privilege too, right, in its own way. And I can't imagine that there's a 16-year-old black child anywhere in this country that hasn't felt different or has been subject to someone's bias or someone's racism at that point in their life. And that's, to me, so sad, right? That's just like, you know, that's, I feel like, privilege in its own way. There's minority privilege too when you're not a black minority. So I don't know. I wanted to put that out there. I want to jump back to the sickle cell thing really quick that Phil talked about. You know, racism, it doesn't have to be a knee in your neck, right? It's this concept of, it doesn't need to be a video of someone shoving a knee into the neck of a black guy for 9 minutes until they die. My whole thing, you guys know, is how do we fight racism in the hospital? Because if you walk into an ER as a black woman, just for being black, you're 5 times more likely to die, right? We see this all the time, and people don't recognize it in the hospital as racism because you're not suffocating someone literally, right? But we are, definitely not listening to patients the way we deserve to. We're not respecting patients the way we deserve to because they are Black. And that to me is a huge problem because the hospital, the medical system runs 24/7, right? And a community, for a community to thrive, a community has to be healthy. And taking away health from a community is just another form of suppressing that community. So this has become such a major thing for me that I, this is all I want to do when I wake up is fight with insurance companies, fight with administrators, pick fights and stand up for this community because we have a real problem in the healthcare industry. And it doesn't manifest any more directly than it does in sickle cell disease, where you're Black, you have pain, you have a need for opioids in the time of an opioid epidemic. You have all of the odds against you at this point, right? Race, a pain condition, a chronic condition, a healthcare system that's biased and racist, a policymaking system that makes reimbursement difficult. You have a medical institution that's teaching doctors in a filter that doesn't include empathy for minorities and Black people. So you guys as sickle cell folks are really against, you really have it the hardest, I have to say. It's very, very challenging seeing it as a physician. I can't even imagine how it is seeing it as a patient. I want to hear a little bit more about that from you guys though. Tell me about racism in the hospital. I know. It's every visit, right? You can't go through every visit, but I mean, what can we do as healthcare providers to start making things better for you? I mean, how do we fix this? Because for me, this is the place where I can make an effect and I want to make an effect, but it requires your voices to be amplified in this situation. So tell me a little bit about that.
Go ahead, Andre.
I thought you were going to. So first of all, Dr. Z, I think, again, like I said, you have that access to power behind the closed doors that we necessarily don't have. Mm-hmm. So that's half the battle already. So I think a lot of doctors have to be more mindful of their voice. You blew up on social media, you know, because of your stance. And I really appreciate that because and not to devalue what you said, a lot of the stuff you said, I said, I'm sure Phil have said on social media for years. But sometimes it takes people in your position, you know, with your education, with your affluence, whatever it may be, to sometimes make an effect. So I really appreciate that you took advantage of your platform and you did it wisely. And I'm sure that because of your willing to be vocal, that there have been changes. So that being said, I really think just like going back to the American Dirt situation, I think what really jades me the most about this community, and I don't even think a lot of people are doing it on purpose, but just like you said, in order to have our voices amplified, then you need to give us time to speak. And so I have been a sickle cell, I guess you could say a professional advocate for the past 5 or 6 years now. And I could count on one hand, the times where I was actually given just, you know, freedom to really speak. Normally I'm invited on a panel and they give me 5 minutes. You say, my name's Andre, I have sickle cell SS, and then pass the mic. And then that's really all I get to say. And that's not really effective. That's not really getting the job done. And I feel like sometimes we could be used as patients to really check the block. Okay, well, we invited the patient just, you know, to save face, you know, to look good for a picture. That's how a lot of us as patients feel. Because when it gets to the nitty gritty, when it gets to going toe to toe with the actual issues, then people, it seems, just from my perspective, seems to shy away from those challenging conversations. I mean, even if we spark those challenging conversations, it's like, okay, well, we don't have that much time, so let's keep it moving. So that being said, I really appreciate this platform because it, you know, it allowed us to speak freely. And this is something maybe Phil could refute, but I don't get the chance to do very often. So I think in order to amplify our voices, we should have platforms where we can speak freely about what has happened to us, and really let people know the issues. Because I've been to certain pharma conventions, I've been to certain, you know, rare disease conventions, and when I had the chance to talk, more than likely it was a comment to somebody else's talk, people always would come up to me and say, oh my God, I did not know this existed, or I did not know this was happening. And because you said something, it opened our eyes, and can you consult with our company, or can you, you know, review this or review that? And those were the times where I felt like my voice was most effective. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a way where the medical community can, you know, do more town halls. I think if you have sickle cell patients, especially like places where I live, where it's a huge sickle cell population here, but mm-hmm. the provider resources are bare to none. If I were to unfortunately get sick today and have to go to the hospital, they would have to medevac me to Duke because there are no hematology specialists here. So they know nothing about sickle cell. Yeah. I've had doctors come in my room and say, we've never heard of it. Tell me what to do. And so if we're in those kind of situations, to me, like I said before, I think it's upon the hospitals, the providers, to provide a platform, to have a town hall, to hear our voices, do something where we could share what we think can improve the system. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the biggest thing. Secondly, I just think patients need to start suing. I think patients need to start really making a ruckus. I think a lot of patients have experienced so much racism or so much discrimination in the healthcare system. Like I said, we get numb. We finally get the help that we need. We get, you know, treated and we get discharged. And then we're on to the next crisis or on to the next life event. And we really never hold those bad actors accountable. And I think if we start really holding them accountable and threatening their licenses and threatening, you know, malpractice, which is probably what they were doing, then I think they may listen to us a lot more. So I hope that makes sense of what I was saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just really quickly, before I jump to Phil, I wanted, you know, I was talking to this, maybe you guys saw it, the episode of my podcast where I talked to Nori Davis, who has sickle cell disease, and he said something that I thought was so appropriate. He said that this is, you know, sickle cell disease is a back of the bus disease. And it's a back of the bus disease,
wow,
not only for patients, but for anybody who's interested in it, right? Like even for me as a sickle cell doctor, it's hard to get the attention of my colleagues and the people who can make a difference. It's hard. It's not easy to have discussions and get people interested and excited, but voices like yours, voices like Phil's is going to help me do that. It's going to empower me too. Phil, tell me what you're thinking.
Again, reiterating, expounding on a lot of what Andre said, I would add that, particularly as pertains to debating whether I should start with sickle cell specifically or versus African American healthcare outcomes overall. Yeah. Let's start there and then drill down to sickle cell.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the psychosocial determinants, right? To steal Andre's line, perhaps. But I think sometimes what happens, especially when we show up in the emergency room, mm-hmm. is we want doctors to be doctors. We want them to be scientists. We want them to, as best they can, get to the root cause of what it is that has brought us in there. And sometimes I understand because of the dynamics of what goes on in the ER, the look can become exclusively clinical. Right. And the point of taking a history is to try to develop a full picture of the patient. But if a patient is coming back to your emergency room over and over and over again, rather than simply conclude the person is seeking drugs, perhaps explore whether or not it's their stability where that person is living or if that person might be homeless. You know what I mean? There could be any number of reasons besides the clinical manifestation itself, that that would bring somebody into the ER. They essentially might be kind of seeking a sick haven for something. Again, alluding to the psychosocial determinants, there's research that suggests that with in sickle cell patients in particular, that when there are instances of depression and anxiety, these things can trigger greater severity of sickle cell complications. And so if there is some kind of destabilizing factor going on that's not necessarily directly having to do with my chart, you know, try to either, you know, implement the resources with the ER to try to capture that full picture. And some hospitals, some do this better than others, where they bring in either a social work or anything like that. But part of it is in how you end up talking to that patient to begin with. And so I understand that that expanded view can't all be the purview of the ER doctor. There are other patients to treat, there's a triage thing happening. But what are the partnerships within the hospital that allow for those kind of potentially underlying causes that aren't necessarily directly related to the physical health, but that could be exacerbating the physical health outcomes? So that's one thing. As pertains to sickle cell specifically, you know, investing in hematologists. You know, I'm sympathetic as somebody who was once upon a time, I was on the pre-med track. I'm sympathetic to the idea that if you go to med school and you might be on that whole hematology oncology track to specialize, you know, if you're coming out of med school with $250,000 worth of debt, it behooves you to go down the path of specialization that will most likely reimburse you so that you can pay off your debt and so that you as a doctor can live a life. The fact that we don't have a number of hematologists who understand our condition benign, you know, it seems like the incentives are in place to drive people more towards oncology. And then it often finds that when feels like when people like us, and I imagine there's overlap in hemophilia and other forms of other, you know, more blood diseases, where there seems to be this tension of getting care here versus what the cancer patients might see, right? And so there seems to be much more oncology doctors available who have this specialization, they understand cancer, than there are doctors who are fighting the good fight on the hematology level. Like, what are the compensation? What are the incentives? Does there need to be some form of debt forgiveness for doctors who pursue that specialization that may not compensate as well as another? And so, you know, this is something I obviously would have to defer to your expertise, because you're more on the front lines with dealing with some of these nuances. But it seems to me that we get the outcomes we get because there's a certain perverse misalignment of the incentives. And so if doctors aren't suitably aligned, incentivized to pursue hematology, we will always consistently find ourselves in ERs where the doctors don't understand what we're dealing with. And they're prescribing medicines that may not be the best for our specific, you know, circumstance and the like. And so those are just two examples or two places, again, to start.
Yeah.
But I think, again, more conversations that like this with other people who have other perspectives and could point us in directions that perhaps Jay and myself have overlooked will be fruitful to the discussion, you know.
That's very insightful, Phil, man. I totally agree with you. We have such a provider issue in sickle cell disease, to the point that I'm a pediatric sickle cell physician, and I can't transition. I can't graduate my pediatric patients to the adult side because I don't have a hematologist to transition them to. So me saying, all right, you're done being peds, good luck, is me saying, I'm going to triple your chance of dying by 3 or 4 times because I'm going to send you out there. There's no one to take care of you. So now I'm just seeing patients older and older because I don't have a choice. And yeah, it's a sore spot, man. The incentivization is a sore spot. But what ends up happening, though, it's a double-edged sword, because what ends up happening is the people then who go into sickle cell disease are going into sickle cell disease for the right reasons, right? There's not many of us, but you've got your, you know, Dr. Drew Campbell's, you've got your Barry Ondemariums, right? You've got your Mike Callahan's, you've got your, you know, these Mike DeBons, you've got these great physicians that are in this area for the right reasons, the Wally Smiths, you know? And I think that makes us powerful too, right? Instead of having people in this for the wrong reasons, right? Like there are, you know, any one of those people I named will go to war with sickle cell patients, right? And fight the system with them. And that makes, there's also some power in that too. I hope sort of selfishly that the incentivization gets better. I'm not gonna lie to you, but don't get me wrong. I think that the family that we have, the community that we've built, it's bigger than race. It's bigger than, you know, class. It's bigger than all of these other issues. It connects us by blood, you know? And that's a really powerful connection that we have. And that's what empowers our community. I think that these open conversations between physicians and patients, listening to you guys, and then spreading these conversations as far as they'll go to whoever will listen is very powerful. Especially when it's people like you who are able to give that message so clearly, that are able to really put aside emotion in that moment and just give facts, you know, really, really draw in an audience. So, I mean, my promise to this community, man, is I'm going to give you as many platforms as I can, and I'm going to amplify you to anybody who's willing to listen. I want to be cognizant of your time because I know you're working too. So you know, as we're finishing this up, man, I just want to give you a chance to give us some closing thoughts here. And you know, I know you've said so much here, but just give us some closing thoughts and give us something to reflect on for us to think about as we continue through this, what I think is like an inflection point on how this country is going to look going forward. Just give us some closing thoughts.
I'm optimistic that a lot of the response we're seeing in forums like this, these are green shoots that, again, they say they revalue what the historical value judgment has been about our voice. You know, because how can anybody care about Black lives if they don't care about Black voices, right? So thank you both for this, for providing venues and forums for us to at least to express our voice and to assign it a value that it has not always been assigned. I think what we as a community also need to do is recognize the strength of our voice amongst and within ourselves, and to turn to each other for the healing we might not be able to get outside of the community. We can be pillars of strength for ourselves, just as folks like you and all the great doctors that you mentioned. You guys are pillars of strength. We draw inspiration from the fight that you guys fight. We know that you guys are given the options at, you know, available to you, that those of you who have chosen this path and to join the trenches with us, particularly in sickle cell, we know that you guys do it from a place, your heart is there, right? It's easy for most people. The lowest common denominator is to just kind of choose, again, follow the incentives, and then you end up at a certain place. But when you look around and you realize that the outcomes that we get magnified and amplified by those incentives, hopefully we can realize that by valuing our own voices, that can somehow work to dismantle the incentives as they exist and make it such that as a community, we are leveraging, we are advocating on behalf of those who aren't always in a position, right? You know, if I'm in a hospital, I'm not always going to be of the frame of mind, you know, or of a low enough pain tolerance, a pain threshold to have this kind of very lucid kind of conversation with somebody who hopefully will is vested in being a partner for a good health outcome for me, as you know, hopefully that feeling is mutual. And but I do think that by continuing to share our voice, which you know, through podcasts like the one like your own and others that that Andre's worked on, we can get
and yours.
Well, Andre's a co-collaborator in that, and even this Bloodstream Media. I think this is where we need to get those voices out. We need to get that community. We need to get the engagement that many doctors whose heart has led them into these trenches, but maybe themselves do not see the options to engage and to move the conversation forward in a productive way. Hopefully this will provide more opportunities for that. So I think there is a lot of power in us that we don't always know that we have and that we can see, but that we do draw a lot of movement and momentum from folks like you guys. So just please keep it going. I know Andre would add so many great ones. Hopefully he jumps back on soon.
He sent a message apologizing. He had to run. He had a doctor's appointment, actually.
Oh, did he? Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Fair enough. We certainly aren't going to keep him from that.
Right. Exactly. So I think as far as closing remarks go, I wish I had something a little bit more.
The last time me and you talked was almost 2 years ago. Yeah. I still draw inspiration from that day that we spent together in Fort Lauderdale talking about, you know, important issues in sickle cell disease and men's health. This conversation is going to push me for probably a decade, man. Don't underestimate the power of your voice. I want to impress on you that you are being heard. We're with you in solidarity, man. And we're going to keep pushing forward to make sure that this is not another Rodney King, that this is not, you know, America stops paying attention. There's no chance. We're going to keep amplifying your voice and we're going to keep going. Okay. That's at least my promise to you and your community. So I want to thank you, man, for spending time with us today. Your time is so valuable and I appreciate that. I hope we get to stay in touch and I hope we get to do this again. Patrick, make this happen for us again, man.
Yeah, this was really valuable. Personally, I'm very thankful for this, and I'm really curious to see what people's responses are. I do want to mention, for anyone out there who, like me, is sometimes coming out of emotional or challenging conversations with a desire for something specific I can go do, there are a lot of worthy places you can put your energy. I'll name one place in particular, a website called 8cantwait.org, the number 8cantwait.org. It was organized by, amongst other people, Duray McKesson, who is an organizer and an activist who has a great podcast called Pod Save the People, which I would highly recommend. There are 8 practices that, if implemented, reduce police violence 72%. This has been statistically proven. And so 8 Can't Wait is about how there isn't time to wait to implement these 8 practices at police departments all across the country to help reduce violence dramatically. So if you're looking for something that you can do, especially if you, like me, are not a Black person or are a white person feeling like there's more I can be doing, what can I be doing? Go to 8cantwait.org, learn about the practices in your local police department and know specifically what you need to be asking for them to implement. With that, I'll echo Amar's saying thank you to Phil. Thank you for this conversation. It will be released as well on Monday via both Cheat Codes and the Bloodstream podcast. And keep up the great work. Thank you both. Have a great, safe, and productive weekend.
Take care. Keep living well with sickle cell, my man.
Do.
Take care.
So what did you think? How are you feeling? Are you okay? Truly absorbing that dialogue could be a lot. It is a lot. So take a moment for yourself to breathe, feel the ground beneath you, and to remind yourself that you are enough. Andre, as you heard, had to Irish exit, as his doctor's appointment was calling. Amar, Phil, and I, though, stuck around for about 10 minutes to debrief. I'd never spoken with Phil or Andre before, and I told Phil how thankful I was to have met a fellow rare disease advocate who saw the world the way that he does, in ways that I learned from and that challenged me, but that I also recognize as familiar for being intellectual, thoughtful, and humanistic. Phil's also got a podcast, by the way, not the filibuster pod that Andre was pitching. Good idea, by the way. But he's got a podcast that I think Bloodstream listeners will appreciate the title of anyway, Blood Brothers, that gets into the issues facing people trying to live well with sickle cell. There's a link to Blood Brothers in the program notes. You also heard Amar reference the Cheat Codes episode that's featuring comedian and sickle cell patient Nori Davis. That and all 10 episodes of Cheat Codes can be found by going to bloodstreammedia.com, where you can follow the links to subscribe to Cheat Codes wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast while you're at it. As I said at the top, I was anxious coming into this conversation. Frankly, I was anxious all last week about Bloodstream content and our social media presence and all of that. I made the call as Blackout Tuesday emerged to cease all promotional posts for the week, having read something that suggested expanding Blackout Tuesday to June 7th for brands and companies not directly connected to the Black Lives Matter movement. As that call shifted to one seeking more explicit support than abstention, we moved to put this conversation together and to revisit our content and promotional plans for the remainder of the month and beyond. We'll continue to seek ways of amplifying and giving space for Black voices and to be better supporters of human rights and social justice for all. I hope you found this conversation meaningful in some way, shape, or form. I hope you'll visit 8cantwait.org, the number 8cantwait.org, to learn more about the ways that you, right now, can meaningfully help reduce police violence and brutality. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. The flagship episode with Natalie will be out on Monday. There will likely be another mini sooner than not. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and until next time, take self-care of yourself and look out for someone else, too. Bye, everybody.